Simpson versus Commonwealth, Ms. Ferret and Mr. Shanville.
Morning.
I take it you've both signed in?
Yes, ma'am.
Great. You have 15 minutes. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, if I could reserve 3 minutes.
Okay, 3 minutes it is. Start whenever you're ready.
May I please the Court, Your Honors? My name is Rebecca Favrat on behalf of Thomas Simpson. There are two assignments of error presented on this appeal. I'd like to focus my argument on the hearsay issue in the 911 call without conceding my second assignment of error, but I certainly welcome questions on either of the issues. With respect to that issue, the reversible error that was committed by the trial court was in admitting a hearsay statement of a child in the background of a 911 call. And the reasoning of the trial court was that that statement was part of a present sense impression of the 911 caller. My argument today is that was error because the court did not have enough information and enough evidence before it to rightfully determine whether the statement itself satisfied a hearsay exception.
Counsel, I hate to interrupt you so early. It seems like the elephant in the room is the ultimate question of, is this harmless error? Because it does come in through the former wife of the appellant, where she indicates the child said daddy. So why wouldn't this be harmless?
I'm glad you brought that up, Your Honor. I think that is an important issue, and I do not believe this is harmless error for a couple of reasons. First of all, at the time that the wife testified that she heard the child say daddy, the error had already occurred. The statement had already been admitted through the recording and had already been played for the jury. The Commonwealth actually brought to the court's attention some supplemental authority of a recent case of Russell v. Commonwealth that this court decided, where there was a hearsay statement that was said to a father of a child, said to the father and also said to a nurse. And because it came in through the nurse, this court ruled that it was harmless error. This is distinguishable because what we have...
I happen to be on that panel, so in that particular situation, though, the court didn't make any finding about the father's statement because there was no objection in reference to what came in through the nurse, and the court never ruled on whether that statement would be admissible or not. So why is that distinguishable from here?
It's distinguishable because those two statements are... The type of statements that we have in that case versus here are very different. In this case, we have a recording of something that happened live and a witness who was there when this happened. And in the Russell case, I'm assuming that the defense argument was trying to keep those statements out because they didn't want those statements to come in the factual allegation of the child that this is who did this to me. In this situation, we have a statement of daddy that we don't know what it means. And so the fact that the wife also observed audibly witnessed the child say this doesn't create harmless error because it's not a different accusation to a different party. It's somebody who, it's a recording of something that happened and a witness who was there when it happened. And so that's...
Are you indicating then that because it's two separate incidents in the Russell case, mm-hmm. that's what makes it distinguishable?
I think that's a very important distinction because factually what the court was looking at there was, well, the fact that the child made this accusation to the father and then to the nurse makes it harmless because he reported that to another person, and that comes into the jury. But here, it's one act. It's one person witnessing it. My argument, defendant's argument, is not that the statement didn't happen. I think it would be different if the argument was this shouldn't have come in because the recording was indecipherable and it was prejudicial because it was argued that it said daddy, but we can't really hear it. And then we have the wife testifying, well, I heard it live and it was daddy. But here, the issue is what does it mean? So when it comes into the jury, they've already heard it on the recording. Having the wife testify about it doesn't add anything to it because it's already been produced for the jury. So I think that's the difference here. I think the fact that the wife also heard it is not adding anything to the case that wasn't already there. It's not...
But I think if the tape had not come in, you still have the testimony that he said daddy.
Which would have been objectionable and which I would have objected to on the record at that time. And I think we still have a hearsay issue in that case. If the tape doesn't come in, the wife's testimony about it is still inadmissible hearsay. And so I don't think it should have come in through that door either.
But it wasn't objected to, I think, is what Judge Decker's getting to. So that part arguably is in evidence.
So first of all, I think it was objected to. I think that the motions in limine were very clear that...
Where was the objection in reference to the wife's testimony preserved in the record? Can you point to that?
Your Honor, prior to the trial starting, trial counsel, which was myself, renewed the motion in limine and specifically articulated that what was being objected to was the 911 call or testimony surrounding the 911 call. We made numerous objections to the content of that call, specifically to the daddy statement and the evidentiary issues surrounding it, that made it clear to the court and to the Commonwealth that what we were objecting to was a hearsay issue about this statement itself.
Statement as made by the child.
Yes, and any testimony about that statement. And so I think that the issue is preserved. I think it
might
was objected
be helpful
to.
For us when you get ready to come up on rebuttal to be able to cite that for Judge Malva.
Certainly, yes, ma'am. And I think also to that point about objecting spontaneously at the time. At the time that the wife testifies, the error has already been done. The error has been committed. It's been played for the jury. And there has to be a point for trial counsel to strategically be able to stay in their seat after this has already been played. And I think there's a big... I think that's a very important part of it, where we've articulated this on the record, we've argued it before, and now it's been played. We can't unring the bell. So she's going to testify about it, but it's already been objected to. So I think that addresses that for now, but certainly welcome any additional questions. I also would say that on the issue of preservation, there is a difference between a recorded statement of a child and the testimony of a wife, of an adult witness saying that this is what she heard. The witness was questioned on cross-examination about biases. Her biases were brought out. That was argued to the jury that she has reason to suspect that this is the person in the home. And so that also adds to the distinction between a recording and the testimony.
So are you saying that for the harmless error analysis, the jury would be more inflamed hearing a child say daddy versus the mother testifying to that?
Absolutely. Yes,
that's
ma'am.
Your point about
that's my
the
point.
Harmless error.
Yes, ma'am, that's my point. Further on harmless error, I know that there was circumstantial evidence that the Commonwealth pointed to, and I think it's one issue for that is that the way that this evidence was presented to the jury and the way that the Commonwealth prosecuted this case was that this statement of the child was the only visual identification of the defendant. And that's very, that became, as I think I said in my brief, that was the linchpin of the Commonwealth's case. There were no eyewitnesses that saw him, and he was not apprehended at the scene or anywhere near the scene. There were not any pieces of physical evidence left behind, no fingerprints, weapon was not recovered.
But he was identified by voice.
He was identified by voice.
At least two witnesses.
He was identified by voice by Erica Simpson only, who was his estranged wife. The boyfriend in the home did not recognize his voice.
But the boyfriend in the home did indicate the person who was present, being the intruder, was speaking to the child in a calm manner. They were having a calm conversation.
Yes.
And
yes.
The vehicle was found about 20 mm-hmm. minutes away with the hood still worn.
Yes, that is the one piece of circumstantial evidence that I think this case has, which is that the vehicle was found near the, not even near, but 20 minutes away. And
with
the
a piece of glass.
And there was a piece of glass that was not tested, so there's no forensics on the glass. There's one piece of glass. And there was no evidence to link this is the glass from the home or anything like that. That was not before the court. And so what we have here is a child saying something that we don't know what it means. And I think that the court assumed a lot of facts not in evidence in deciding that this was satisfying the hearsay exception. And I also think the Commonwealth asked the jury to assume a lot of facts not in evidence in deciding that this was an identification of the assailant. But as going to the hearsay issue, the reliability is not there. We have no idea what this means. And so it's reversible error because it significantly impacted the jury's decision. Without it, you have the voice identification of an estranged wife who has reason to suspect the defendant as being the assailant because they have a protective order and he's been sending her all these threatening text messages. And you have the car being 20 minutes away at the cousin's house. That's it. That's all we have without the statement of the child, which is framed as the identification. Argued in closing, this is how you know. This is how you know this is who did it, because a child knows his daddy.
But you still do have the testimony of the mother that she heard the child.
Right, but that is encapsulated by my argument, Your Honor, because that was objected to. I objected at the time to the statement of the child as being hearsay. So it's hearsay if it's on the recording. It's hearsay if the wife testifies about it. And the court has held, I think it's the Lear case, that the purpose, as we know, of objecting during trial is to make sure that the trial court is on notice to exactly what we're taking issue with so that they can make a proper ruling.
So are you saying your assignment of error includes the statement of the ex-wife?
I think that it can, Your Honor. I think that,
has to either yes or no.
The issue in this case is the statement of the child. And in any form that was objected to, I think that my assignment of error is specifically about the recorded statement.
Right.
But the testimony of the wife does not negate that objection, because the testimony of the wife was also objected to and was also produced at a time where the error had already been produced in front of the jury. So it was objected to, it was preserved. My assignment of error refers to the recording itself. But I think if the statement of the wife does come in, it's much, much less damaging to the defense. It's much less of a slam dunk piece of evidence for the Commonwealth, because this is through the biased lens of an estranged wife who has reason to suspect, and her perception is questionable at this time, everything that's going on, being the victim of a home invasion. All of these things can be argued to the jury when it's just her testimony, her recollection, versus the recording. The recording is much, much more powerful, and it significantly impacted the case. It was the case.
Counsel, you can do whatever you want, but you're into your rebuttal time.
Yes, I will rest then for now.
Thank you. Mr. Shandoval, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, Chris Shandoval for the Commonwealth. In his first assignment of error, as the court has just been discussing, Simpson argues he's entitled to a new trial based on one word that came in through the 911 recording. And as the Commonwealth has asserted, that argument has to fail because that same word came through the estranged wife's testimony, Erica Simpson's testimony. If you look at pages 309 through 310 of the record where she testifies as to that statement, it's clear that while the recording had just been played, the prosecutor then asks her to, says, "You said you can hear the defendant in your home," on the call, and then the prosecutor says, "I want you to describe for the jury what you heard." And she asked, "You mean during the altercation?" And he says, "Yes, during the altercation." So the answer is, "During the altercation, I heard him say, 'You N-word,' to Javelle. And then later, I heard him say, 'It's okay, Joe,' when he said, 'Daddy,' in the hallway." And then on page 310, the question is, "Did any of your children say anything?" And she says, "They said, 'Daddy.'" So she's clearly testifying not about what she heard on the 911 recording, but she's testifying about what she remembered hearing at the time that this occurred. So based on that, in 1923, the Supreme Court of Virginia held in Witten versus McClellan that it is a well-established rule and principle, and an acceptable principle, that an appellant cannot benefit from an objection that was made at trial when the same evidence came out later in that same trial and was unobjected to. If that principle is well-established in 1923, it's certainly still well-established today, and we have case law since then that holds the same.
I take it your point is that there's a waiver?
Yes, Your Honor.
Let me ask you about that, because for waiver, there has to be cumulative evidence, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
The court in this particular case never makes a firm determination as to the hearsay, but indicates it's part and parcel of the mom's present sense impression exception to the hearsay.
Mm-hmm.
What does that do to the waiver argument? Because it comes in under a different theory.
Well, it comes in under a different theory initially. So regardless of whether or not, and there might be an argument that Mr. Simpson failed to obtain a ruling on that particular statement in the 911 recording in the first place. So I think there might be a waiver argument as to that, but I think
well,
it's a separate.
Different. That's a separate waiver.
It is. But I think it's separate, and the fact that it's a separate issue it means that it really doesn't have any effect from the Commonwealth's perspective. How the judge ruled on the initial objection, the fact that later when the same statement came in through a different form of testimony, there was no objection made at that time. So there was no ruling at that time. So there is a waiver. And all of these cases discuss same or similar testimony coming in later in the trial. Sometimes it's the same witness testifying on cross-examination or testifying later on in direct. Other times, though, it's completely different witnesses, as you saw in the Russell case, as we've seen in other cases cited by this court and the Virginia Supreme Court. So the fact that there was an objection, there was some sort of ruling made initially, it doesn't implicate whether or not there's a later waiver when there's no objection made to the same statement coming in through different testimony or different evidence. I don't think it matters that the evidence is in a different form. There's been an argument made today that because her statement was somehow different or less harmful to her argument, to Simpson's defense, than the 911 recording, that should make a difference. Virginia courts have never assessed, well, let's look at the types of testimony and decide which might have been more harmful to defense. The only question is it the same or similar testimony, and was there an objection? And the obvious answer here is that it is the same or similar testimony evidence, and there was no objection.
Well, it's at least an interesting argument to say that the jury, particularly since it's a jury trial, that the jury hearing the child on a 911 tape saying daddy versus the testimony of the ex saying that she heard the word daddy, that the tape could have a more chilling effect on the jury than the cold testimony of the ex.
Sure, it's an interesting argument, and because a lot of this case law was before the time of 911 recordings, we don't have a lot of cases exactly with the exact same facts, but the principles announced in those cases still apply equally if it's the same or similar testimony. There's never been any weighing of, well, was this witness more persuasive than the other witness? Was this witness more credible? Did this witness describe it in a somewhat more specific manner that could have hurt the defense's case more than the other? The question is always same or similar testimony, and that is what we have in this case. And that really gets more to, I think there are two separate arguments. There's an argument that there is a waiver, and then there's an argument that there's harmless error. So the argument she's made about, well, maybe the video recording was somehow more prejudicial, so it's not harmless error because the testimony wasn't as strong and didn't hurt the defense. That really goes to the harmless argument, but it doesn't get to the waiver argument. The waiver simply asks, is it the same or similar testimony? Was there an objection? If not, the issue is waived. Now, there's an argument made as to harmless error that there was an objection made early on in motions in limine. If you read the written motions in limine, they all refer to the 911 recording. Never is there a reference to testimony about independent recollection of what happened at the time of the offense. Additionally,
your position is that the ex, her testimony is not referencing the 911. It's referencing what she heard the child say.
It's not referencing what she remembers hearing on the 911 call. It's referencing what she remembered happened at the time of the offense. Now, she's remembering the same statement that the 911 recording records, but in order to object to her testimony about her recollection, there would need to be a specific objection to that testimony about her independent recollection. The only objections, in the motions in limine are all about the 911 recording. The written motions in limine don't even reference the child's statement at all. Those objections are made on the record at the pretrial hearing about the motions in limine. And if you look at, starting on page 122 of the appendix, the objection that's made repeatedly is an objection to where the child exclaims, "Daddy," in the background. So in the background of the recording, and then argues on page 123, the main reason I would assume that the Commonwealth wants the 911 call played, but those statements are absolutely hearsay as a child, et cetera, et cetera. So repeatedly references the 911 recording and the statement on the 911 recording. When it later comes up again at trial, at pages 166 through I think about 170, through 170 of the appendix, again, there's an argument from defense counsel, different defense counsel on page 166, that you can't come in through the back door to take an incompetent witness and have him present basically testimony through that 911 tape. So again, it's an objection to the statement on the 911 tape. You see 911 tape mentioned again and again and again from 168 through 170 of the appendix.
That's a reference to the motion to reconsider, though, that you're talking about.
It is the motion to reconsider the earlier ruling on the motion in limine. So it's still getting back to that objection to the statement coming in, but again, focused on the 911 recording. There's never any reference to an objection to the wife testifying about what she remembers happening, her independent recollection. In fact, on page 170, defense counsel actually mentions the fact that Erica Simpson is going to be here and she's going to testify. And that's part of the argument that defense counsel makes, that anything she says on the 911 tape shouldn't be admissible because she's going to be here and she's going to be allowed to testify. So while recognizing that she would be here to testify about what she remembered, there's never any objection to her testifying about those statements. And that's what you would need in order to avoid a waiver, which is certainly what occurred in this case, as we've argued. So that gets both the waiver and I think the waiver is the nearest and best grounds of resolving this case. I think it's harmless for similar reasons. And once you get to the harmless error analysis, you also get to look at the other evidence in the record. There was an identification by the victim's wife. She testified that she was very certain that this was the defendant's voice that she heard. She'd been married to him for about 7 years by that time. That was certainly competent testimony, that she recognized his voice and that was strong evidence that that was who it was. You can hear her identify her husband on the 911 recording. She tells the operator, "This, my husband's here, he's broken into the home." So it's clearly an identification that was made instantaneously. She knew who it was and continued consistently throughout testimony. Of course, he also showed up a half hour later at his cousin's home, which was about 23 minutes away, and said, "Hey, my car's breaking down. Can I have a place to sleep?" Strong evidence that he was coming from the victim's home, and that's how he ended up at his cousin's house in the middle of the night. And so taking all that together, it's clear that any error was harmless. There's been an argument in the reply brief, I guess at page 6 of the reply brief, that the text messages, and I think the argument is in reference to the first assignment of error, but it also gets to the second assignment of error. In the reply brief, Simpson argues that you can kind of discredit the wife's testimony because she had a reason to believe that this was her estranged husband. She was kind of biased against him. And if you look at page 6 of the reply brief, what is actually argued there specifically is that less than 3 weeks before the burglary, starting at the bottom of page 5, Ms. Simpson had obtained a protective order after receiving hundreds of text messages from her estranged husband threatening violence. So that argument is made, put forward to support the idea that you should not believe the wife's identification. What that, I know it wasn't intended as a concession, but what it essentially concedes is that all those text messages that were sent from that phone were sent from the husband. That's the argument that is made. Of course, the second assignment of error before the court is whether or not those text messages should have come in, and the argument is that, well, they weren't authenticated as coming from the husband. Well, she's essentially conceded on the reply brief that they did come from the husband. And I anticipate that counsel will attempt to walk back or limit that concession in rebuttal. However, I think regardless, it illustrates something that everyone recognized, the trial level and here on appeal, is that Mr. Simpson sent those text messages. It is very clear.
Is that concession of fact or concession of law?
That would be a concession of fact, who sent the text messages. That's clearly a concession of fact, which would be binding on the court. I don't think it's a concession that was made at trial, so she can try to take it back in rebuttal. But regardless of whether the court treats it as a concession or not that's binding or not, it illustrates the fact that it's plainly apparent to all involved, the trial court, the parties below, and even the parties now on appeal, that those text messages did come from Mr. Simpson. There's really no one else identified in the record who they possibly could have come from. Ms. Simpson does a very good job in her testimony of explaining how she concluded those text messages were sent from her husband. She talks about how they reference being the father, they reference being the husband, they reference her being the wife, they reference their sons, they reference the divorce that they were anticipating might be coming. So for all of those reasons, the authentication of those text messages was more than sufficiently established in this particular case. So those text messages were certainly admissible on those grounds. They were prejudicial because Mr. Simpson used some very strong language in a lot of those text messages. But they're prejudicial because of the words that he chose. And they're only only can be more prejudicial than probative if they didn't have any probative value. And clearly, they helped to establish the identity of the person who broke into the home. They helped establish that he had motive to break into the home. They helped establish the malice that he had towards Ms. Simpson. So for all those reasons, they were highly probative. They were not more prejudicial than probative. And for all of those reasons, those statements were properly admitted into evidence as well. So for all of those reasons, we assert that both assignments of error do fail, and that the trial court was correct, and that the conviction should be affirmed. And unless there are any further questions from the court, I'm happy to rest on my brief and ask the court to affirm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Gavrett?
Yes, Your Honors. First, of course, I'd like to address the Commonwealth's point that the appellant somehow conceded that the text messages were sent from the appellant. That is simply not the intention of me including them in the brief. The reason they were included in the brief and the reason that they are argued as being potential sources of bias for Ms. Simpson is because that is what she testified to. These text messages were presented as ones that she received, and so that was argued once those came in that she had gotten these threatening text messages. I certainly do not concede that they were sent by the appellant or that the proper foundation was laid or that they were properly authenticated. I don't believe that they were properly identified as being sent by Mr. Simpson, and it is not the burden on the defendant to present alternative senders to the fact finder. And so for that issue, I would just simply say that that is absolutely in no way a concession of fact by any means, but is merely argued through the lens of the witness who is testifying with a potential bias. Back to the harmless error issue, judges, I want to point out that the record does indicate that the this was not a slam dunk case for the jury to decide. The circumstantial evidence that was brought forth by the Commonwealth is not something that they were able to make a decision on quickly. This jury deliberated for almost 3 hours and received an Allen charge before they decided. And unlike the testimony of Erica Simpson, they had the recording of the child back in the jury room with them. And I would submit to Your Honors that that is something that they listened to in deciding who committed this offense. And because of the way that it was argued, because of the way it was presented, it was a major deciding factor, and that's what makes this reversible error. I think I've already addressed the issues about the subsequent testimony by Erica Simpson, and for those reasons, judges, I would ask that you reverse the convictions. Thank you.
All right, we will.